Welcome to the People's Game, Pacifica Radio's coverage of the 2010 World Cup soccer tournament in South Africa. I'm Alan Minsky. On today's show, we'll be talking to Robert Edelman, author of Spartak Moscow, A History of the People's Team in the Worker State, and we'll be asking him what he thinks of the 2010 World Cup, both on the field and off the field, as a site of political contestation. And then we'll talk with Mark Torres from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Mark is a diehard football fan, but he also has quite a bit to say about what he sees as the social and political subtext of this year's World Cup tournament. But before we get to Mark and Bob, there's some news coming out of South Africa today as workers have gone out on strike, and this includes not only the security guards at stadiums, but also there was a bus strike in Johannesburg. There's a lot of money being generated by the World Cup tournament in South Africa, and it sounds like the workers are going to ask for their fair slice of that pie. That is a story, of course, that we'll continue to follow here on The People's Game. Another thing we'll be talking about on The People's Game is the question of whether this World Cup and the enthusiasm over it in the United States represents a significant break with the history of soccer in the United States as sort of a second-tier sport. And indeed, the television ratings have come in from the first round of games, and they represent a spectacular increase over previous World Cups. In fact, 108% increase in viewership in the early games for the World Cup tournament. And then web traffic in the United States is at a level never even come close to before in terms of people following soccer. So remember to tell your friends to subscribe to the podcast for The People's Game, because what you get here, you ain't going to hear on ESPN. And the way you do that is by going to kpfk.org and on the right-hand column, clicking where it says Pacifica Radio, The People's Game. Follow the directions and sign up for the podcast. Once again, that's all available through www.kpfk.org. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky. Right now I'm joined by Robert Edelman, who is a professor of history at the University of California, San Diego. And he's also the author of Spartak Moscow, A History of the People's Team in the Workers' State, which was just awarded the Book of the Year by the North American Society of Sports Historians. Welcome to The People's Game, Bob Edelman.
It's great to be here.
Well, I want to talk to you in a moment about looking at the 2010 World Cup and looking at social and political subtext of this tournament as we've experienced it to date. But at the top of the show, let me ask you first, you're also a huge soccer fan. What do you like about the teams on the field so far?
I'm not a huge soccer fan. I'm a slightly overweight soccer fan. I'm very excited. You know, first games are always a little tentative, right? And so obviously some of this has been more tentative. But I think the skill level is surprisingly high. I remember being disappointed in 2006 that a lot of the teamwork seemed very disjointed. And I think what I've seen so far is that there's a decent amount of fluidity in team play, which I might not have expected at this stage. You know, given the length of people's club seasons, given their level of fatigue, it's really not bad at all.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about just this past day is, of course, there's this whole deal with European sides winning in Europe. And in 2006, don't forget, the four semifinalists were all European. And then you play out of Europe, and the Brazilians generally win. But in the Western Hemisphere, the Europeans have never won. So 2006, right, the European sides are tight, they're structured, they're well-disciplined. Maybe a lot of the other sides sort of come into the tournament with a no-hope attitude. Because I think we've seen a lot of positive play from a whole variety of teams so far in 2010.
You mean because everybody thinks they have a chance?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I don't know. I mean, that's a good point. But, you know, Brazil did make the final in 98, and then there was all that craziness around the final, you know. But
well, Brazil always has a chance. But, I mean, all the other teams that came into 2006. It's just a theory. I'd have to go back and look at the games.
I have to think back about 2006. And try to recall that. I'm not succeeding at the moment.
Well, a lot of teams went out early who weren't European, and in the end of the tournament, it was all Europeans. You know, Mexico actually played very well. Remember, they were very positive against Argentina. Argentina looked good until they basically mismanaged their way out of the match against Germany.
They took Riquelme out just when he was doing well.
Right, and they had that mess up with their goaltender in that game too. But, you know, again, Argentina is in the category of Brazil, so it would be looking at the other sides. And, you know, right now we have some positive results from Asian teams, and we have a few positive results from African sides, and we have positive results from, or, well, draws from the two local sides here. We're in Southern California right now. By the way, let me, before we get into the, again, political and social subtext, I believe that if USA makes it out of this group, gets to the second round, this actually might be critical mass for soccer in the United States. This might be the moment where it really has captured the general public's imagination. Will enter into the whole global community of soccer, at least to a greater degree of a nation with a balance of serious soccer fans, because it's the biggest prize in global sports, and I think America will catch the bug.
Do we know what the overnight ratings were for the U.S.-England match?
Yeah, my understanding is that they were very good, exceptional for U.S. soccer. No doubt a product of globalization, and with that thought, on to what you can see, Bob Edelman, about social and political context of the 2010 World Cup tournament.
I think as someone who sort of had a front row seat back in the 80s on a couple of levels, one when the apartheid struggle was really heating up on campuses and being involved in that, but also sports was always such a big part of the whole question of the struggle against apartheid, that I'm viewing the present situation with massive but pleasant ambivalence. Now, I will tell you that when they played the South African national anthem at the beginning, I did cry. You know, I was very moved that this had happened, but there's so much that has happened since, and so many people who perhaps don't deserve to be congratulating themselves, like Sepp Blatter, who, you know, has found, you know, on one level it's good that he's had this in South Africa, or Africa in general, and that he had this kind of mission to do it. Of course, the mission is to spread the brand and the product and all the rest of that, and to perhaps also maybe even the playing field for Africa in terms of the terms of trade that go on in terms of talent vis-a-vis the European teams. But I do find it all a bit strange. I mean, you've got still the massive differences of wealth in a place like that. Soweto has not disappeared. That can't be forgotten. On the other hand, to see these stadiums, although we know that the resources that went into them probably could have been, you know, more humanely spent elsewhere, there is something about the fact that they have the capacity to do it, and they have done that. Yes, there have been a few problems with a little bit of theft here and there, and the odd airplane that shouldn't have, you know, gone up but did go up, and fortunately everybody survived. But otherwise, you know, I have to be impressed by that. So it's hard to make a single conclusion about it. I think one thing you could say is that there is something, though, of the fact that this machine of both American television, world television, the FIFA itself and all the sponsors thereof are congratulating themselves. And I would have to say ESPN does a pretty good job of recalling the past history and not hiding it. But one does have to ask where a lot of these folks were, you know, back in the 1980s.
Right, for sure. And, you know, we spoke to Savas Michael Matsas from Greece who about the Greek national side before they took the field and really stunk it up the other day about the economic crisis in Greece. And one of the things he brought up was that the expenditures for the 2004 Olympics were part of the backdrop to the crisis with the Greek national economy. So now, and of course, South Africa is a little bit of a different kind of economy. It's not part of economic union the way Greece is. And of course, it is a resources and mineral rich country. The unemployment situation in South Africa is atrocious. And yet, you could see that there could be a bubble that could crash and burn in South Africa because of all of the expenditure that went into this for stadiums that really won't be used in the future.
That was my next sentence. We're definitely looking at white elephants.
Right.
Now, unless rugby in South Africa as a league, you know, a club experience is bigger than even I think it is, and we know it is pretty big, it's hard to see those stadiums being full.
Well, my understanding is they can't fill them.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so.
Right. And what about other aspects of this taking place in the context of the global financial crisis? Any reflections on that?
Well, those things are very tricky because these things are planned so far in advance.
Right.
And, I mean, this is the what's happening with the London Olympics right now, where they made a plan that was relatively ambitious, and I'm understanding they're having to scale it back. And then, of course, there's this massive political change in England, whereas, you know, it was a Labour government that sort of brought the Games to London, and now we have a Conservative government, which may be a little less cosmopolitan, shall we say, in its attitude to the outside world, which is now going to oversee it. That's the nature of mega events, and mega events always raise these problems of, you know, there's better ways to spend the money. Sometimes, though, it works out, like in a situation like Barcelona, where it does have a synergistic impact and actually improves situations. There's been some others as well. They're not all disasters, say, like Athens, though.
Now, in your book, Spartak Moscow, A History of the People's Team and the Workers' State, it's one of the brilliant books on soccer that, you know, this is a source of great working-class solidarity throughout the long arc of soccer's history. It was a source of anti-colonial solidarity, even though the game was brought to Africa from Europe and, of course, across Europe. You know, I grew up partly in England and Italy, largely in the United States, but, of course, in England I understood it to be an incredible source of working-class solidarity. That particular theme, how do you think that resonates right now in 2010?
It's interesting because there are founding myths, right? Every club has its founding myth, and especially in a place like England or Scotland even more so, the founding myth is one of, you know, workers' teams or factory teams or local neighborhood teams or pub teams. And it's something that really expressed and generated identities. I mean, football, soccer, has always been a kind of identity, a great generator of identity formation. And that has an impact on politics, right? If you have a sense of who you are and those solidarities are based not just on the factory but on things like neighborhood and community, they become even more powerful, and I think that's what did happen over the course of soccer history. Since the formation of the Premier League, and, of course, the Hillsborough disaster and all the rest of that, there's been this attempt to squeeze the working class out of certainly elite soccer. If you want to see what working class soccer and that whole tradition and that history was, you have to go to see games at the lower levels, say, in a place like England.
Though I can tell you that the stands for a Wigan Athletic match in Wigan do not resemble the stands at Stamford Bridge for a Chelsea match.
I would hope not. By the way, their coach, who's on ESPN, is very impressive.
Yeah, and that's my pet side in England, as it were. So,
are you a perverse fellow?
I am a very perverse fellow. I chose them, though, because the top four, of course, always play off against my favorite Italian side, so I can only have so much affection for any of the top-flight British sides. And Wigan was bringing in all these fantastic players from Latin America,
right,
but not from Brazil or Argentina. And, yes, he is super sharp. Roberto Martinez.
I'm hoping he is the one who will succeed Wenger.
He, of course, had a very good day today as his newest recruit, Alcaraz, put in a goal against Italy. Alas, Robert Edelman, author of Spartak Moscow, A History of the People's Team and the Workers' State, winner of this year's North American Society of Sports Historians. Great to have you on the People's Game.
Thank you.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and joining me in studio is Mark Torres, diehard Southern California global soccer fan. What do you think so far, Mark?
Well, I have to say that there's been a few surprises, some not-so-surprises. I would have to say that currently I'm very happy that my two favorite teams, Mexico and the United States, have escaped with a tie in their first matches, which
were both salvaged comeback ties.
Yeah, and then we've seen some front runners stumble. Argentina barely squeaked out a one goal victory, but they did get by with a victory. It could have easily have been a five goal victory, but it turned out to be a single goal, which is always precarious. We saw Germany dominate yesterday with a 4-0. Victory, and they look very strong, although the two goal scorers, Klasa and Podolski, both had horrible regular seasons. So, again, these two superstars shine on the world stage, and they make Germany look dominating.
Italy, the team that I've rooted for my entire life.
We just saw that finish just recently, yes.
Old men on the pitch, lumbering along. Yeah, it's somewhat of a sorry sight, but my thoughts are, well, they were lousy in 86. They won in 82, were lousy in 86. This time around, they're pretty weak as well. And
although you would argue that that was because of the manager's choices of who would be on the team.
Yeah, I think they could be a lot stronger. I think it was clear they have a real lack of creativity up front. If they had Totti, they'd be stronger. Again, I thought Luca Toni stronger, really, and more dangerous to opposing defenses than any of the five forwards that they have right now on their roster. Of course, Pirlo wasn't in. But, you know, that's the thing, is you put Cameron Nasi in with Pirlo, with Totti, and all of a sudden you have a very creative nucleus right there. Pirlo's not on the field, Totti's not on the team, and even though Totti is old, still, you know, when the field is packed in, when they're not playing counterattack football, then Totti is just an incredible asset to have.
That's what I would actually have to say about the World Cup soccer matches so far, is that teams could be made up of superstars, but unless they play like a team, they're not going to do well. We saw the United States actually play fairly decently as a team. We also saw how Cameroon earlier this morning did not play as a team. They have arguably one of the best threats on the pitch, which is Eto, and he was negligible. We saw Wayne Rooney for the England team really not making an impact for the England team. So if you don't play well as a team, even though you're packed with superstars, you're not going to do well.
Right. And, you know, Italy, actually, I think that's something behind Lippi's theory here of what he's brought along. I mean, the team has considerable cohesion, but just not enough of a threat up front. And obviously, I can go on about the Azzurri a lot, so I'll leave it there for now. Team USA, definitely, they held to their strategy very, very well. Let's see now how they approach the side, right? Slovenia, in which they'll have to be more creative and assertive, not just sort of play off of what the opposing team gives them, because there's going to be opportunities for them to be creative and to put the opposition on their back heels in the upcoming game. And sometimes I think USA is weak in that regard. Now, Argentina, for what it's worth, you know, I came off of that game, again, a little underwhelmed with Messi, but compared to Rooney, I mean, if we're looking at the five or six top offensive players in the world right now, definitely Messi over Rooney. Now, upcoming tomorrow is the group of death, and the group of death brings maybe Didier Drogba. If he takes the field, I'll be astonished. Certainly Cristiano Ronaldo will be across from the Ivory Coast. That is probably, for the most of the world, I think, the most intriguing first round matches that's there. I mean, certainly USA and England grabbed all the headlines here, and South Africa and Mexico, the opening game around the world and also in this region. But Ivory Coast and Portugal is certainly something everybody's waiting to see. And then Brazil, North Korea, certainly there's a perverse interest in that match, but Brazil taking the field. And then we've yet to see Spain, of course.
And Portugal.
And of course we didn't see Ian Robin today and when he'll come back, but I thought they sort of escaped with a victory there. I thought by the second half of the first half today, Denmark had the better of the play.
They were supremely unlucky.
Right, that
was an own goal.
Well,
on a clearance.
The thing about that, it's true. He cleared it then into the back of his own player, but when you clear the ball back into the middle off a standard corner like that, you know, you're going to get yourself in trouble. And then, of course, Holland put him to sleep later with a nice offensive move thrust down the field there.
And we've only seen one African team escape with a victory so far, and that was Ghana, and they were very fortunate to get a penalty kick. Other than that, the best that Africa could muster would be a draw, and there were losses along the way as well.
Right. Well, Algeria, of course, really dug themselves into a deep hole. They now have to come back against England. Could really be facing elimination right away.
Well, there were three goalie gaffes that really were significant so far. That was the Robert Green gaffe for England, which I don't know if you could argue that was the worst of them. Certainly the Algeria muff, the Algerian goalkeeper was in position to make it, and he just could not judge where the ball was going. He was just offline, but he was in position to make a stop. And then we saw Italy, I think, rather fortunate to escape with a draw today because the Paraguayan goalkeeper really came out when that was really unnecessary, and Italy was fortunate to get a goal on that particular play. So those were three goalie. I think this brings into attention the magnitude of the World Cup. The pressure is humongous. The weight of the crowd, the weight of a country weighing on you. Gaffes like that can happen, and it's not just an isolated incident. We've seen it happen, and there is probably going to be more. They're just going to be more significant as we continue on.
Well, I think for poor Robert Green, in terms of the breadth of his life, it was pretty damn significant, because of the three of them, that was still by far the ugliest. And it was, of course, one of the highest profile matches to date. And with any of the teams that have the most popular national leagues, they naturally get an incredible amount of attention because so many people are familiar with the players on those sides. And the EPL is the most popular league in the world, I believe. So everyone's watching, and boy, that's something going to need a little therapy, very soon.
That's a lifelong memory that is hard to live down.
Right. And, even as much as England was eliminated by a terrible gaffe by Carson in goal against Croatia, eliminated for the Euros in 2008, nothing like the first match of a World Cup to really just, okay, that's going to be in the first line of your biography. It's going to be on your gravestone. So, Mark, lastly, the whole tournament, the spectacle, here we are, progressive journalists, the World Cup, the event in which humanity pays the greatest attention to it. And I mean, the only other event in the world that rivals it, in my opinion, is the United States presidential election. And I interviewed the philosopher Slavoj Žižek about the World Cup and ran it on yesterday's show, and he had said about the U.S. presidential election that everyone in the world should get a vote. Well, the U.S. presidential election also lasts about a year. This is a month. It's incredibly concentrated. What do you make it as a social, contemporary, historical spectacle?
Well, interestingly enough, I think that we could take advantage of the strength of that type of popularity. I mean, I know wars have been put on hold as a result of matches being played. If you can turn that into a positive, put that in a bottle somehow, that would be amazing. One other thing that stands out, and I think it stood out most beginning in Germany, when Michael Ballack, representing the host nation from Germany, came out with a statement against racism. And many of the commercials that I've seen on ESPN or other stations that are broadcasting the coverage include these end racism commercials. And I think that's highly significant, especially being on the continent of Africa, who have been the subject of racism for centuries. So I think if we could parlay some of these positives, that this is a sport that transcends borders, it transcends languages, it's very much like music. It's something that everybody can relate to regardless of cultural barriers. I think that when we get to a point where we're one people, one planet, that will be the sport that is played.
Well, I was talking with my wife, who's British, about it, and she's not a huge fan of spectacle sports. Certainly enjoyed playing field hockey when she was a young girl. But I said to her, look, we understand about the human species that there is aggression in the species.
And competitive nature.
Competitive nature in the species. And everybody understands about sports. Does this encourage that, or is it a appropriate way to channel it, as opposed to other forms that would be worse for society? Just out and out fighting, people fighting in bars, in the streets, wherever. And, I'd argue that, yes, it's a good way of channeling all of that. And on top of that, you have in this spectacle, and also for a Women's World Cup, you have at the absolute prime of people's physical prowess in all-out exertion, and it's as beautiful as ballet, right? So, of course, people love it. It's not aggressive. It's a joy to watch. So many people participate in the game at some level, so it's a craft that they participate and they can associate with. Okay, so taking all of that, people love it. People watch it like nothing else in the world. I'm trying to construct an argument here, and I'm building it in my own mind. So here are my cliff notes. Don't anybody steal it from me right now. But I'm thinking, as simple as this, okay, arguments for like social democracy or socialism. The World Cup soccer, playing soccer, is better than economic anxiety, right? Can we all agree on that? Okay, playing soccer, watching soccer is so much fun, right? This is so joyous. It's a point for saving the earth from devastation, okay? We can all maybe agree on that. But in terms of the economic anxiety, some of the top soccer-playing nations, when they really developed their national games in the post-World War II context, they were European countries, or they were in the stage of national development in South American countries where you had expansive welfare state programs. So you had middle classes developed. The rich people paid excessive taxes so that everybody could be economically secure and they could pay more attention to soccer. I think that would make people happy. It's a new argument for the left. I'm working on it. It's just embryonic at this point. But it's not a joke at the same time. This is something that people really love, and it's worth having economic equity so that we can all love it equally.
Well, there's something to be said for that, but something that definitely transcends all socioeconomic barriers, that's what soccer does, whether it's on a dirt field, a desert field, a patchy grass field, on a concrete surface, it doesn't matter. This is something, or whether it's in, Wembley Stadium, in the most manicured stadium on the planet. The thing is that everybody can participate in this. It's really not there's really no barriers. Although I would argue that bowling is the most socialistic sport that you can have, because they have a handicap where somebody who isn't as good as somebody else can be as good because of a handicap.
But I think if bowling was what we were asked to follow and love more than any other sport, we'd be a very depressed species, I think. This is an open field. You run full energy. I mean, your endorphins lift. Your endorphins lift just watching it. You know what I mean?
That's something that should be required maybe for every citizen to engage in before they go to work, before they go to school. That should be a 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. endeavor in our lives.
Your inner Stalinism is coming out here with the shoulds. But the
the United States here, if you listen to a lot of the sports coverage, especially here in Los Angeles, they characterize soccer as running around for a few minutes. Somebody fakes like they're injured, and then they get up and they run around for a few more minutes and then repeat as above. And they don't look at it as anything that's very spectacular because the score is so low. They think that if it's a 0-0 draw or a 1-0 score, that it's absolutely boring. But somebody who's a follower of soccer, the subtlety that goes in dribbling, the buildup of the play, as you said, there's so many poetic moves, so many ballet moves that are involved in a run-up. And, what we saw from the Nigerian goalkeeper, we talked about some of the worst in goalkeeping. Well, there was some of the best in goalkeeping because
he was
Messi
great.
Probably would have scored 4 goals that day if it wasn't for that goalkeeper. He was amazing.
Yeah,
he was blocking
solid.
Things from the top far corners that other goalkeepers would not have gotten to. And, so from goalie to defenseman, there's amazing athleticism and creativity involved.
Well, as for 0-0 draws, of course there are ones that are snoozes, right? However, when it's a highly competitive situation and teams are really with their heart trying to attack on both sides of a 0-0 draw, I mean, think about it. It sort of begs the question, how many orgasms do you want to have in a day? Okay? Seriously? I'm not 17 or 18 anymore then. So here's the thing, right? It's, right? One goal, the whole game then. When it's 0-0 in the 80th minute, one damn goal is going to win the game. Right? Here's the thing about it. If it's a competitive game, the game is going to be close. It's not going to be a blowout down the stretch. It's not like a baseball game, 8-1 in the 6th inning. You can drown yourself in donuts and beer. They got great health food at a lot of baseball stadiums, right? So, it's a very, the way the game plays out as a competition does generally assure close matches. Again, goals can happen quick. I mean, we've seen where teams are up 2-0, then the announcers say it's this goal puts it to sleep, and it ends up 3-2. So it does happen that way. Now, at this level of competition, it's true there is really a premium on goals, except less when Germany's playing right now. I mean, they definitely did not – they showed no cynicism. They drove at their opponents.
That and the fact that Australia, poor down under brothers, just did not play very well at all. It was
very unfortunate. Hey, they almost scored in the first, like, 3-4 minutes, and that would have made the game considerably different. But alas, we've waxed poetic on the beautiful game. Maybe bad poetry on my behalf. But that's all I'm capable of, I've discovered across my days. But
I'm rooting for the kids of Mexico. The kids of Mexico, the front three are truly amazing. Giovanni Dos Santos Hernandez that just got signed to Manchester United that are being guided by the veterans like Marquez. And hopefully they'll be able to hold up strong in their group and move on to the elimination stages. But, you know, as we move forward, it's only going to get better. By the time we get to the 16, the 8, the quarterfinals, and the semis, it's going to be truly an amazing event. So we have the world's attention.
Well, here's the thing about lastly for Mark and myself, because we are really diehard fans of club football throughout the year, every year, right? By the way, my little pet team, Wigan Athletic, is getting the media. We got Roberto Martinez, the goal scorer for Paraguay from Wigan Athletic. Both goalkeepers, right, in Serbia versus Ghana, Wigan Athletic.
And a manager as the analyst.
So hopefully this will really bring people into Wigan Athletic. It's a side that has been bringing non-Brazilian and non-Argentinian Latin American players into the EPL. The Honduran team will have three current or former Wigan Athletic players. And I love the side. They have the smallest following of any club side in the British Premiership. So a lot of props to Wigan. Now, here's the big question, though, for soccer in this country. I think with the England-USA match, if USA advances out of the group, goes to the second round this time, I think critical mass achieved. U.S. soccer on the radar screen like never before in this country. And here's the thing. While it is true that there were some empty seats in a couple of the games, generally the crowds have been pretty full. The media attention is really on this. People sense that the rest of the world cares more about this than anything else. That's going to get into the American psyche. I mean, not everybody is like, you know, a let's conquer everything and crush everybody type of Texan mentality. Let's rule the world. Let's beat them down. We're America. We're number one. But I do think that within American cultural consciousness and sports sort of mass social psychology, when we recognize that when it finally registers that this is the biggest thing in the world, I think it's won the attention of America now.
Right? I think so. I think, Landon Donovan has been an incredible ambassador for soccer here in the United States as the greatest goal scorer in American history. The fact that Clint Dempsey is doing so well in the British Premier League, that Tim Howard is doing great on Everton, that many of the United States players are making an impact on the world level. I think we can steal a couple of athletes a year away from football and basketball and baseball to secure a truly athletically gifted team leading into the future. So I think that the United States doing well in these next few games will help capture the imagination of some of these wonderful up-and-coming emerging athletes.
Mark Torres from the Pacifica Radio Archives, huge fan. Club side is Liverpool. Occasionally he plays center, striker for Liverpool. You've seen him on the pitch. Great to have you here live in studio. You'll notice him on the field for Spain.
Great to be here.
And that, folks, is our show for today. I'm Alan Minsky, and I want to thank my two guests today, Robert Edelman, author of Spartak Moscow, A History of the People's Team and the Worker State, and Mark Torres. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The People's Game here on Pacifica Radio.